Welcome to another podcast episode of DIY Guitar Making. I also produce video episodes of DIY Guitar Making live in the workshop. To find both the podcasts and the videos all in one place, go to DIYGuitarMaking.com. You can even subscribe to the email list there to receive new episodes, both the videos and the podcasts, directly in your inbox as they come out. Again, that's DIYGuitarMaking.com. Hello, friends. Welcome back to DIY Guitar Making. We're going to do Q&A today. Let me first just give you a little rundown of what's going on in the shop, because that's always interesting. And my shop looks like a tornado hit it right now. There's all kinds of stuff on the bench here because I have multiple projects going on at once. I'm building these molds for the... See, this is the start of the mold for my Florentine cutaway parlor. And I got some other things too, which is back here. It's a mess back here too. This chair actually I picked up on the side of the road, and I'm gonna replace this broken netting here with a piece of wood. This will be for my daughter and my son. They can both sit on it. It's a chair. I'll also today be working on bending sides for the hands-on guitar build workshops that are coming up soon. And that's basically it. Got the wood stove going. Yeah, I'm ready to start my day after we do some Q&A. All right, let's jump right into the private members forum and I'll answer your questions there. All right, so we're gonna jump over to the private members forum, and then as per usual after that, we will jump over to YouTube and check out some of your questions and comments over there. The way you gain access to the private members forum, by the way, is by being a student of one of my online courses or one of my hands-on workshops, okay? All right, so there's been a lot of activity in the Discord forum, which is fantastic. So I'm gonna go through this. There's a lot of really great questions here. I might not make it to YouTube just because there's so much good stuff in the members forum today. All right, so we'll start here. Richie has a question about vertical sawn versus flat sawn, and in vertical sawn, he means quarter sawn. So quarter sawn versus flat sawn backs. Richie writes, I am starting my second build and a friend gave me locally sourced walnut. I was going to use it for the back, sides, and neck. I believe it is flat sawn. In Eric's recent video, he says, flat sawn for a top is a big no-no. Does that apply to the back also, or can the back be flat sawn? It will have to be a three-piece back using this material. Okay. You can absolutely use flat sawn. There's a continuum between quarter sawn and flat sawn, with everything in the middle being a degree of rift sawn, right? And you do see a lot of backs. It's very common to see backs with sort of that cathedral figure to it. Figure isn't really the right word there, but that they call it cathedral. Maybe they do use the word figure. I don't know. I'm not sure if that's a misuse of the word figure, but I'm going to use it anyway. When you see that cathedral figure on a back, that means it's either flat sawn or approaching flat sawn. And that's very fine for backs. Now, some people will tell you, and they're not wrong, that ideally the backs would also be quarter sawn because they're thin and flat sawn is less stable, so more likely to cup and warp and all that over time. So you're using a less stable material, but honestly, if it's sourced really well, which means it's kiln dried or just dried, it could be air dried or whatever, it's just dried really well, then it's less likely to be a problem, which is why on the back, people just accept varying degrees of flat sawn. I do it. It's fine. It's okay. The reason the top is different, by the way, one, you're using a softwood, which is more affected hygroscopically by the conditions of the environment as far as moisture is concerned. And also, there's more going on the top. You have your bridge glued down with all the tension and torque that is applied there, and your fretboard tongue, right? And all your neck geometry. So there's a lot that can go wrong even with just a little bit of distortion on the top. Whereas if the back does get a little bit distorted here or there, it's generally fine as long as it's not extreme enough to separate braces from the back or anything like that. Okay? Long answer, but the short answer is just go for it. I use material approaching flat sawn very, not carelessly, without worry. That's the word I was, or the phrase I was thinking of there. I do that without worry. Okay. Owl Lush writes, the topic here is handy scarf joint miter box. Okay, so Owl Lush writes, I remade this scarf joint miter box with some ply that I had left over. Very easy to make yourself, and the cuts with a handsaw are great. The photograph is from Giddy's Design. Okay, let's take a look at this. That looks really slick. So this isn't the one he made, I guess, but this is where he sourced this design from. I like that a lot. I've never seen that before. So for you guys who are just listening to this in podcast form, audio only form, this is a miter box that, you know, kind of like you would have a miter box for cutting your fret slots, but it has an angled, in the vertical dimension, there's an angled cut, which is probably somewhere in the ballpark of 15 degrees. And you can just place a handsaw on that, slide your neck into the box, and make your cut there. But it looks like the design here is really well thought out. If you just see how some of the joints are done to hold this thing together. That is cool. I like that. I don't mind doing it the way, I don't have an issue with the way I do it now, which is just to run it through the bandsaw and then plane the joint just a little bit to true it up. But if I was just getting started, I would probably go ahead and make this. Very cool. Definitely going to share that. That is cool. I like that. Thank you, Owl Lush. Just realized this is in a jig sub form. My apology. Oh, that's fine, Owl Lush. That's fine. So yeah, you put this in the wrong part of the Discord forum. That's okay. I'll let it slide. All right. So Larry Kuhn has a question about white-ish bindings. So he writes, I want to do a herringbone dreadnought, mostly like a Martin D28, and I'm wondering what to use for the bindings. I'm not going to use white plastic. If I wanted a plastic guitar, I'd just go out and buy one. Yeah, I agree with that sentiment for sure. Maple is the obvious idea that comes to mind, but I'm wondering if I can do better. I don't think boxwood is any lighter hued than maple, and basswood is too soft. I'm wondering if anyone has used holly. It's expensive enough and hard enough to source that I wanted to see if anyone has used it successfully for this purpose or has any better ideas. Thanks. P.S. In addition to refusing to cave on plastic, I'm also putting double fret dots right where they belong on the 12th fret and only the 12th fret. And I don't care what crazy ways the people in Nazareth do it. Okay. That's all fine and well. So yeah, to get to the heart of your question, you want to replace the plastic bindings or not use plastic bindings, but still maintain the general sort of color tone and look of a traditional Martin D28. And I would say just go with maple bindings because, you know, those guitars had like a cream white plastic, and that's kind of what you're trying to match, but without it looking shitty like plastic does, with it looking a lot cooler. So if you use maple, and especially just for a little extra flair, you might as well use a nice flamed maple. That is going to maintain that look, but without being a cheap material like plastic. And which, by the way, I completely agree with that sentiment. I say it all the time. If you're going through all this trouble to build a guitar, and it's a lot of work, as the majority of you guys know. I know some of you guys are just getting started, so maybe you don't know yet, but it's a lot of work just to build one guitar. And if you're going to put all that time into it and you're not simply a manufacturer of guitars, I understand why they have to, you know, have different priorities than us and use cheap materials, and you know, they've got targets to hit as far as price points. I understand that. But for us, it's a lot different. It takes us a really long time to build a guitar. It's not expensive to buy whatever binding material you possibly want. It's such a thin material that it's quite cheap. So using plastic, it's just kind of like, why? There's kind of no excuse for it. It's a little easier to put on, though. I'll say that. So if you're building a first guitar, sometimes it does make sense, actually, just to use plastic. But anyway, that's just me agreeing with the sentiment. The answer to your question, I would say, is just go with maple. I don't know anything about using holly, but maple bends great, and you can get some really cool figure out of it, and it's sort of a classic wood binding look. So maple, and that color tone is going to match a cream plastic binding look very well. And I think some other people wrote some answers here. Patrick, okay, so he agrees with this. He writes, I think maple is your best bet. And Lamar's Guitars also writes, hard to beat the look of maple binding. By the time it is bent and sanded, it will have a nice figure, no matter how plain the original binding strip looked. Yes. Yeah, maple, maple, maple. And actually, I'm looking at the picture, his little icon in the Discord channel here, and he's holding up the guitar from the class. So Lamar took my class in 2020. He took it in 2020, and we actually used maple bindings on his guitar. Okay, he requested that at the time. And they came out fantastic. In fact, looking at that picture, if I recall, I think it's a Zeracote back and sides and a redwood top. It might be Western Red Cedar. It's hard to tell. It's a very small picture. Yeah, with flame maple binding. Maple is your best bet, as Patrick said. Okay, and another question from Larry Kuhn. This one is about soundboard advice. And he writes, Eric has inspired me to try two new things. One, parlor guitars, and two, Wenge. So I'm going to do two parlor builds, one with a Wenge back and side, and the other with a parlor-sized black Limba back and side that I have in my collection. What soundboards do I pair with these? I have some salvaged redwood I want to build with, and some red cedar. I also have various species of spruce. Aesthetically, I think the cedar and the redwood can go well with either back and side, and could really pop with a careful choice of bindings, rosette, bridge, and fingerboard. Tonally, what do you all think? Since these are my first parlor builds, I'm a little unsure about how best to compensate for the smaller volume and the tightness of a small guitar. What tone woods are more of a match? Okay, so tone wood questions like these are always not my favorite thing to answer. And I know you're not even asking me directly. You're asking the community, which is great. And so I'm hoping some other people will give their opinions here. And I'll go ahead and give mine a little bit, or at least the way that I would think about this. So I'm not even going to look at your question as like a pairing. You know, I'm pairing the top with the back and sides. Not to mention, I've never used black Limba, so I don't even know how that would be. But I'm going to think of it more. I'm going to take your question as the way that I would look at it, which is, what choice of top material should I use for to compensate for the effects of a extremely small bodied guitar, a parlor guitar? Because that's the more important relevant factor here, is you don't want to do anything that exacerbates the brightness, which is already inherently there with a small bodied guitar like that. So, you know, for an extreme example, you wouldn't want to use a mahogany top. You know, you can use mahogany tops on orchestra model size instruments and dreadnoughts and things like that. But on a very small bodied guitar, I mean, I don't think it would make it an unplayable, unenjoyable instrument, but it would certainly add in a noticeable way to the brightness of a small-bodied guitar by using something like mahogany, which you're not asking about anyway, which is very good. But what I would do, so just going gut level here on a small-bodied guitar like that, and actually this is what I did for my two power guitars. I went with the Western Red Cedar. I didn't overthink it either. Like, I'm not even sure if that is the best choice, but my gut from using all three of these woods that you mentioned, which are Western Red Cedar, Redwood, and various spruces, the spruce, I think, has a shorter envelope of attack. So that's why people talk about, especially Adirondack spruce, they talk about driving the top. You know, bluegrass players who really like to drive the top, meaning punch those notes out, tend to like things like Adirondack spruce, which I believe the way of understanding that is because it has a shorter envelope of attack. And so you want something that's the opposite of that. And I think the Western Red Cedar, in my experience, tends to resonate a little bit longer at those lower frequencies, I think. Anyway, I don't want to go too far into that. I don't want to get any deeper into that, except to say that I would just go, my gut tells me Western Red Cedar. Okay, but you can't go wrong with any of those choices you mentioned. I would just try them out, and hey, if your gut says spruce, then go with the spruce. It's not going to, especially if you're tap tuning your tops. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to go any deeper into this, but now I am. If you're tap tuning your tops and even your backs, because when you do the bracing on your backs, you can carve and tap and carve and tap, just like you do on the tops, in a somewhat similar way, maybe a little bit differently. But if you're doing that anyway, and you're not just putting pre-shaped braces onto your tops and your backs, then if you're listening well enough, you're going to build your top and your back essentially the same regardless of what material you use for it, right? So if you start out with a spruce top and you put your bracing on there and you carve it and you tap all the way until the top is responding in the way that you like, and then you build a second guitar with a Western Red Cedar top and you carve and you tap until it basically is similar to that first spruce one you did, then it's kind of like you started at two different points, but you arrived at the same place. That's the way I sometimes look at it. So a lot of this like pairing mentality comes from the manufacturing world, and it's not inherently wrong, the pairing mentality. It's just that it matters far less, and to some degree it doesn't matter at all, in the boutique world where you're actually voicing your materials, your tops, and maybe your backs. Not everyone voices the backs, really. Okay. Take all that with a grain of salt. Fun to talk about, but it's the kind of stuff where there's no right answer there. We can get into it all day, but in the end it becomes very, you almost end up talking about semantics, and also just becomes very subjective too. So there's that. Next question. All right. We got Richie. Again, Richie writes, I am getting back to my first build parlor guitar. Man, so many parlor. I love this. I love this. Ever since I started doing the parlor stuff, a lot of you guys have taken up parlors as well. But also I will say I started doing the parlor guitar because there's been a little bit of it seems like there's been a resurgence of interest in building those size instruments. So part of why you guys are, I'm seeing this more too, is just that same trend continuing upward. I am getting back to my first build parlor guitar plan from LMI after knee surgery and rehab. I am coming down to the wire, literally preparing to install the fret wire. Ah, see what you did there. I happened to look at these beautiful wooden bridge pins that LMI sent me and saw that they are not slotted. Do I have to slot the pins or can I use them as they are? So, no, you can use them as they are, but you then have to cut slots into your bridge. And not your bridge before you attach it, but actually after you attach your bridge to the body, I'll show you what I use right here. I have it right here. This little saw, which you can get from Stu Mack. They probably call it a bridge slotting saw because they always tend to give you names that tell you what the thing does, which I appreciate that they do that. It doesn't have a esoteric name. So this little saw right here is essentially all you need to cut those slots into your bridge. And then you can use unslotted bridge pins. And actually, that is the better way to go. Slotted bridge pins are a bit of a hack to save time. Okay, that you see them a lot in, you know, commercially manufactured guitars, because then you don't have to pay someone to sit there and slot the bridge. The reason you need to cut these slots after the bridge is glued is because the slots aren't only cut into the bridge, they are actually cut into the top to some extent and into the bridge plate underneath, okay? Because you're taking the saw and starting with a vertical cut that cuts into all three materials, the ebony of the bridge, the spruce of the soundboard, and the maple of the bridge plate. And then you turn your saw at an angle as you're cutting towards the end to make your slot into a little bit of a ramp at the top, because that ramp is going to sync up with the angle of the string exiting the bridge pin hole. And you can also get, you don't have to get these. Where are they? I thought they'd be right here, but they're not. You can also get these little files to smooth out your slots that you cut into the bridge. And you don't need them. You can just leave your slots kind of rough, but it's a little bit nicer, as you'll see, if you do get those files, because it cleans up the look of those slots. The whole thing is smoother. But yeah, you can still use those bridge pins, but you can't use them without, I wouldn't use them without getting this tool. Okay, you'll notice that when you tune things up, the bridge pins will just pop right out. They don't have the space in there. In response, Patrick writes, if you cut slots in the bridge pin holes, you can use unslotted pins. Exactly. That's what we were talking about. David Schiff writes, in fact, I always use unslotted pins and slot the pin holes. Stu Mack, I think, sells a special little jab saw for this, but I embedded a saber saw blade into a little wooden handle and it works great. Okay, yeah, that is basically what Stu Mack is selling. It seems like Stu Mack has done exactly what he's talking about, but then they put a price on it and brought it to market. Larry Kuhn writes, Stu Mack sells two different ones with different widths. They also sell a set of files for fine tuning. I think Driftwood did a whole video on the advantages. Yes, I wanted to mention that too. So if you're interested in doing what I just talked about, look up Driftwood Guitars. I'm sure you know who they are. If you find my videos, you've definitely seen theirs. They're huge. Look up, they have one or two videos, it might be a two-part thing, on doing exactly what I just talked about. Okay? And you can just follow that along as a tutorial. Yes, so that's all I'm going to say about that. And let's jump around here. Okay, nothing there. Looking through the Discord. Okay, another question from Larry Kuhn. Lots of questions from Larry Kuhn today. Larry Kuhn writes, it's a question about a light box. Larry Kuhn writes, hi all, before I start my next builds, I'm taking some time to make new jigs and improve my existing ones. One thing I want to buy slash make is a light box. As Eric showed in some of his recent videos, they look really useful for jointing and even for tracing. I don't have a lot of room in my garage shop. Eric's in-bench light box seems like a luxury. It is. It is. You definitely don't need it. And for most people, you shouldn't even do it if your space is small, because you're taking up a chunk of your space with something permanent that can't be stowed away, and that's not good. So if space is critical for you, don't build a light box into your workbench, please. And just for you guys who haven't seen it right here, this is what he's talking about. This is my light box. I actually have a tracing on here right now. But more commonly, this is used for the jointing process to candlelight my seam between the book match pair. All right, back to his question. I don't have a lot of room in my garage shop, so I want something I can easily store and pull out when I need it. And I'm thinking 24 by 24 inches. For the light source, LED seems like the obvious way to go. Beyond that, I'm a novice when it comes to lighting. My big question is how much light the thing needs to put out in order to be functional as a light box. LED lights seem to be measured in lumens, but the lumens seem to be a function of the size of the light and not just the intensity. E.g., a 4-foot light will put out twice as many lumens as a 2-foot light. This complicates determining if a light is bright enough. Given that I want to use a 2-foot light, how many lumens should I be looking for? Is 4,000 lumens sufficient, more, less? Okay, I'm going to stop there just to address that. Someone else here might have a better, more technical answer, but my answer is I really think you're overthinking it. What I did with mine is before I started building it into my workbench, I just had a light. I found a light amongst the junk that was in my shop, and the size happened to line up with where I wanted to put the light box. You know, it was about like 2, maybe 2.5 feet in length, and that was good for me. And I didn't even think about the lumens or the brightness. I just don't think it's that critical at all. I really don't. There's no light, reasonably speaking, that's going to be too dim. Okay? Because, I mean, your window works great, and that's not, 4,000 lumens. Anyway, I think you're overthinking it when you get into considering lumens. My second question is, rather than building a box and installing a fixture, would a panel such as this one from Lowe's do the job? All right, let's check it out. Yeah, these panels, I've seen them at Lowe's. They're for ceilings and bathrooms and stuff like that. They actually are essentially light boxes. And if I had built that when these were popular, so I built that like well over a decade ago, a long time ago, and you did not see these big LED panels like you do today at Lowe's or anywhere. And this would absolutely work even better. I would have used this if I was building this today. So you got it right here. You nailed it. And that basically is your light box. You could stow that whole thing away. Boom, you're done. You don't have to build anything. There you go. Oh, and this happens a lot in the forum because it takes me a while to get to these questions. Larry Kuhn writes, addressing my own question, I went ahead and bought the one at the link above. Looks like it's going to work fine. See samples. And he's got some pictures of it in action. Yeah, that's great. That's better than the light box I have because mine, my light is much smaller. And it's a little bit harder for me to line up my seam with the light itself, whereas you have this big, broad LED light. You could actually hold whatever you're holding there, you could hold in any orientation, and you'll be able to see the light through it. And the same with tracing things out. It's going to be all the better that the light is distributed over a wide area rather than concentrated in one place like mine is. Very cool. LC Guitars writes, looks like it works well. I have a large picture window in my shop that I use. That works too. Yeah, you don't need to overthink things like that, I think. Very good. Okay, and the next question is from Mir690, and it is about the fretboard angle over the top. Mir writes, I am starting to fit my neck after routing the mortise and tenon. Because I set an angle to the neck, the fretboard is not flush over the top. I noticed that in the videos, that's the same, but Eric doesn't mention it. So basically, when gluing the fretboard edge, we are actually forcing that gap, thus creating a bit of a hump in the joint so we can radius sand it later. And Patrick responded there, I sand a tiny bit under the fretboard tongue and a tiny bit on top of the fretboard tongue. I also sand the top a tiny bit where the soundboard will sit near the sound hole. Yes, so Patrick basically has it there. So, and also you answered your own question to a small extent there when you said, so basically when gluing the fretboard to the top, we are actually forcing that fretboard tongue down a little bit. Yes, if it's very extreme, though, if that's a huge gap that you're, or a huge hump that you're leaving at the 14th fret, then you, there are ways throughout the build process that you mitigate that gap. And also it might be a sign of your angle actually being off a little bit if you really have to force that tongue down, right? But yes, to some extent, that's why I advocate for radius sanding your fretboard after it's attached, because that gives you a lot of leeway as far as eliminating that 14th fret hump that you get from getting your neck angle and then gluing the fretboard tongue down. But when you're at this stage, as you are right now, you're about to glue, attach the neck to the body, you can now see how much forcing you have to give on that fretboard tongue, and you can mitigate that a little bit. Again, if it's extreme, if it's not, if it's extremely slight, then go ahead and glue it down and it will very quickly just go away through the fretboard sanding process. But if it's fairly extreme, you can mitigate that by, as Patrick pointed out, first flattening that area of the top where the fretboard tongue is going to seat. Flatten that area, or not flatten, that's not the right word, but true it up to the fretboard. So essentially set an angle into it, take a little bit off the sound hole side with a well-set block plane. Now, if your plane skills aren't up to par, maybe your sharpening skills aren't quite there, that you think your plane is just going to tear up the soundboard, maybe don't use a plane here. But what I like to do is use a plane, have it set up well, set up very to take very fine shavings and don't set it up coarse, and cut yourself in a little pad at the top of where the fretboard would seat, and then take a sanding block. Here, I'll show you. Like this, about this size, and continue to flatten that area with a little bit of sanding. And essentially what you're doing is you're putting the angle that the neck is extrapolating out over the top. You are, to a small extent, putting that angle into the soundboard. And then you'll notice after you do that, when you go to clamp down your fretboard tongue, it will have less travel down to meet the soundboard. You're not trying to eliminate it 100%, because getting rid of the 100%, you're very likely to overly thin your top then. I'm always cautious to that students will take this too far. Okay, and Russ G has a question about back reinforcing strips. Hi everyone, I'm having difficulty finding back bracing strips like LMI used to sell. So he's talking about the back strip, which is the cross grain. It's kind of like a ply, an alternating ply of grain that runs across the center seam, the seam of your book match on your back. And the one that runs down the back joint with the grain running across the width rather than lengthwise, he writes. Any suggestions? And let's see, LC Guitars writes, I think you are talking about the strip on the inside of the back, correct? You can cut the cross grain strip off of the top or bottom of your soundboard blank if it is long enough. If not long enough, you can buy an orphan piece of a soundboard to make it as well. Yes, absolutely. Let me show you what he's talking about. So here, let's take a look at this soundboard right here. And so what we're talking about here is you've got yourself a backstrip of cross-grain spruce right here at the bottom. So after you join these, you can cut this whole long piece off right here, or you've probably got a couple of them up here at the top. As you can see, I can probably get two full backstrips before I encounter my outline. Okay, and this is going to depend, of course, on how much length you have to your set. You might be very close to your outline, in which case you won't have it. So, but like LC Guitars mentioned, just get some extra spruce, then you can cut these out yourself. But that's all it is. And also, I mean, you can assemble this. So let's look at it this way, too. So your strip is going between your braces anyway. So you can install your braces first and then assemble little pieces of strip. So let's say if I didn't have a lot of material outside of my outline, I could take small little pieces like over here and right there, maybe a couple out of the waist, and I can just assemble my whole backstrip that way. All right, fixing tear out on a soundboard. Richie writes, I have completed my first build following the online course, and to my surprise, it turned out pretty good. It sounds great, really long sustain. Well, that's great, man. That's really awesome to hear. Anyway, when the weather breaks here in New Jersey, I want to get to finishing with Tru Oil. I have a chip out in the soundboard, which occurred when routing for the binding, and I am wondering what to do with it. In one of Eric's recent videos, he suggested that sometimes doing nothing is best. That's the way I am leaning. Don't want to screw up the top. I thought about spruce dust and super glue, looking for ideas. The soundboard is spruce and the binding is rosewood. No spruce dust and super glue. Don't do it. bad things will happen. Yeah, do not do that. It will not look good. It's going to look kind of gray. That's the color you get. And not to mention, there's no, so on a light colored wood like spruce, if you use a dust filler, if you fill it with dust, it's going to be very obvious because the grain lines of the spruce are very obvious on the part of it that's not damaged. And you very much so will notice the difference between the damaged area and the undamaged area because the grain does not continue into it. On dark woods, you can get away with it because the color of the grain, the bands of dark grain lines and the wood in between it are both dark. And so there's like this obscuring effect. So you can get away with it a little bit more. Light colored woods, nope, you can't get away with it at all. So you got to be very careful with your fills, whatever you use for it. So yeah, no dust and super glue or dust and any glue. I would not consider that. I like that he mentioned what I said before. That definitely rings true. If it's small enough and it doesn't bother you that much, and you know where you're at experience-wise, like maybe you're just not super confident in your ability to execute that repair, then leaving it alone is probably a good idea. Now, you could say the good way to learn to execute those repairs is just to do it. Yeah, I'd agree with that as well, too. Again, if you don't mind your guitar being a guinea pig for that experiment. If you know you're going to keep building guitars and this one instrument is just the first of many, then yeah, just give it a shot and know that it might not be completely invisible. However, if this is your baby and your one guitar, or maybe one of just a few, yeah, you might want to let it go. But the real answer here, if you are going to attempt it, is to, what I would do, and he has some pictures here so I can take a look at it. Yeah, and that's a fairly good size. What I would do there is take a piece of spruce from your build. I'm sure you have some scraps, like the sound hole cutout is a good piece. And honestly, what you're trying to do, it sounds kind of obvious, kind of so simple that might think that that wouldn't be the answer here. But actually what you want to do is find a scrap piece and try and draw out the shape of that cavity that you have as accurately as you can. And keeping in mind the where the grain lines run across that empty space, try and match that up as well on your scrap piece so that two grain lines, I can see there's two grain lines running into the damaged area, those two grain lines also run onto the little filler piece you're going to create. Draw that out, cut it out very carefully and accurately. It's not going to be perfect because this is freehand, but you're trying to get it as close as you can with a jeweler's saw. So essentially in the same way that you would cut out inlays, you're going to cut this out like an inlay because essentially it is an inlay. And then test fit it. It's probably going to be a little bit oversized. And you're going to carefully, with a very small needle file, and you can hold it in a nut slotting vise or something, a nice small vise like that. If you don't have that, you can hold it with a set of pliers. And you're just going to very carefully shape that until it slips right in. And I would glue that in once it just carefully goes in. I would glue that in with tight bond and not with super glue, because the other reason why I don't want you to use super glue and dust, like you mentioned before, is because the super glue is going to stain the spruce pretty deeply, often to the point where you can't even sand out that stain. It's a common thing with CA glue and spruce is that it leaves a good stain on there. You can get away with it sometimes if you're very careful. In this case, though, because you're gluing sort of into the end grain of the damaged area, that glue is very likely through capillary action to travel up into the end grain and be made worse, the look of it. Anyway, that's the way I would approach that fill right there. There's a picture of the damaged area that Richie left up here, which I'll throw up on the screen so you guys can see what I was talking about there. LC Guitars writes, no matter what, it will be visible, but it does need to be filled with something to level it off. Maybe a light brown CA glue. I don't think so. But, you know, different opinions are fine. It's so small, it will blend into the binding pretty well. Yeah, and he's right about the, you know, you can do things and it will be pretty good. Now, he said something about leveling it off. I don't think it's necessary to, you know, I have guitars with little divots in them that I decided, okay, I'm not even going to deal with that. I'm just going to leave that in there and call it character. And I just let the finish sink into it, let the chips fall as they may, so to speak. And that's not a problem. It doesn't have to be perfectly level. I'm not going to like slather pour filler into it or anything like that. So I just let the finish sink down into it. Okay. But yeah, I would not use CA glue there. But if you did want to, like he's saying, the light brown CA glue, if you just wanted a quick fix and you really wanted it to be level but didn't really mind it looking kind of obvious, yeah, you could do the light brown CA glue for a quick fix. Patrick writes, I would patch it with a tiny sliver of spruce and glue it in with tight bond. Ding, ding, ding. Yes. I like that answer. CA glue will leave a dark line around the patch. You might not even need it, glue it. I don't know what that last part. You might not even need it, glue it. I don't know. Oh, you might not even need to glue it. I know what he's saying. The little sliver, you could just kind of press it in there. I would rather have tight bond on it, though, to know that it's in there. Lamar's Guitars right, second Patrick's suggestion, with knife or scissors, whittle off several slivers of spruce. You'll eventually get one that is a pretty close match. Fine-tune as necessary, tight bond, and it'll be pretty darn good. Sand from spruce toward edge, so any dust-filling minor crevices are spruce and not rosewood. Yes, very good, Lamar. Yes, that I would like to add that too, what he said there about when you sand it at the end, you do want to be careful because you're right on the edge of... well, I think you had ebony bindings there, not rosewood. You're right on the edge of that dark ebony. And when you first stick your sliver in there with the not yet cured glue, the still moist and wet glue, you don't want to then with a sanding block pull those little black dust particles from the ebony binding into the tight bond and accidentally mix it in with it. then you'll end up with a more obvious witness line all around the fill. Something, so that's just something else to be wary of. And this is the kind of thing, as I said before, and as these other guys were chiming in about, it really is the kind of thing where it's not going to be perfect. It can be very good, but it's not going to be perfect. And so it becomes the kind of thing where you try and do the best you can, but you also take it as okay, how do I make sure the next time this doesn't happen again? All right. That's always how you approach the top with the darker woods. I mean, little chip outs and stuff. You can make those totally invisible very easily. Spruce is tough, man. It's tough. So you learn ways to just make sure that it doesn't happen again. You learn to respect the spruce. Okay, and Ronald Vermeer is commenting on a thread that is in the forum on lint in your finish. And we talked about this in, I think, the last Q&A, where I mentioned a whole bunch of suppliers, a couple suppliers, not a whole bunch, where you can actually buy French polishing cloth. So instead of sourcing your own lint-free rags and not really knowing if they're truly lint-free or not, there are places where you can buy, I believe it's called trace cloth or just French polishing cloth, and those are very much truly lint-free in my experience. So sometimes it does make sense to just buy that cloth and not have to worry about it. And Ronald gives us another source for it in mainland Europe, which is nice for a lot of you guys out there who live in mainland Europe. Ronald writes, for those that live in Europe, you can get lint-free cloth from suppliers that supply materials for French polishing. As I live in the Netherlands, I buy the cloth at, and he has the link right here, I'll put it up on the screen, but it's politoeren.com, politoeren.com. All right, so for you guys living in the Netherlands or just in mainland Europe, there you go. There's another place that you can get lint-free cloth from and not have to worry about sourcing it yourself. Okay, well, Mars Guitars has a question here. He writes, or a comment, I guess. He writes, Eric, two things. Purposefully risking putting this in the wrong place on the forum, but number one, it's not exactly clear to me where on the Discord we should reply to something in your DIY guitar videos. It seems like new episodes only has the videos. Should we try to find the channel or forum that is the best fit for the questions you pose? No, actually, I'm really glad to see. I noticed that too, that nobody would ever disrupt the flow or the post of new videos in the new episodes segment of the Discord. And I think that was just because nobody had done it. And so I think everyone was waiting for somebody else to, be the first person on the dance floor, so to speak. But actually, that always kind of perplexed me that nobody ever wrote a question underneath the actual videos themselves under new episodes. But absolutely, you can and should do that. I think it would make for a very logical flow of dialogue. And ultimately, if you're ever asking yourself that question in the forums, like, should I post here? You know, as the person who moderates the forums for you guys, I'm saying if it seems to make logical sense as far as the flow of conversation that would exist in that thread there, just go for it, okay? And I'll let you know. I'll chime in as I've done in other places and say, hey, you're putting these questions in a place that causes problems, let's say. But yeah, thanks for asking that, and thanks for being the first person to post a good comment here underneath the video, because it makes sense to comment there. All right, so his actual comment or question here is, number two, as for flat versus quarter sawn necks, I have made, so in the recent video, the reason why I'm saying this is because I did a video about using flat sawn material instead of quarter sawn material for a guitar neck. Now, continuing with this question. As for flat versus quarter sawn necks, I have made three necks out of an oak I cut down and have two more blanks standing by. The trunk was relatively small and I was lumberizing it with hand tools, so I had to take what it would give me. I jokingly refer to the necks as Omnison, since I really didn't have any control over the angle that would give me big enough pieces. At any rate, after curing and sizing the blanks, all of the necks, some one piece, some with separate fretboard, some are one piece and some with separate fret. Okay, I got what you're saying. Okay, some are one piece and some, actually, I don't understand that. Anyway, I'm just going to read it without that part. At any rate, after curing and sizing the blanks, all of the necks have remained as straight as could be. And the oak is so hard, if I drop one on the concrete floor, it sounds like I've dropped a metal pipe. You'll do fine with your maple. Okay. Yeah, because in the video, this is new to me, actually, using flat sawn lumber for a guitar neck. I've just always done, for the most part, mahogany necks and not maple. Maple is more commonly used for electric guitars and still used on acoustic guitars, but less commonly. So I was actually unaware that using flat sawn material for guitar necks, that anybody did it. But actually, a lot of people use flat sawn lumber for maple necks, and especially if there's figure there, that's the only way to see the bird's eyes, if it's bird's eye maple, for example. So anyway, I did a video on that and blah, blah, blah. We talked about a bunch of things, and he has just given me a little more confidence there. As many of you did on YouTube, which we'll get to your YouTube comments soon enough, as many of you guys also chimed in on YouTube and said, hey, you know, I use flat sawn all the time. Here's another reason why to use it. And so I appreciate that, guys. This is what it's all about. The feedback that we both get. I get a lot from you guys coming back my way. So thank you, Lamar. And let's see. I think we have a new member introduction. Jerry writes, Jerry just took the hands-on workshop with me. So I just spent a little over a week with Jerry here. Jerry writes, hi, I'm Jerry from Tennessee. I was in Eric's guitar building class in December and just got the finish on and restrung my new guitar yesterday. I built a ukulele during COVID, working with a nearby luthier, and hope to build a parlor guitar or baritone uke on my own over the next year. The guitar I built with Eric sounds really great. My finish, well, I'd give it a lower grade. LC Guitars USA writes, welcome, Jerry. Finish work seems to be the hardest part of achieving a professional look to an instrument. Just remember to take the time to let things dry or cure, follow the recommended steps, and learn from any mistakes. Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely echo that sentiment. Finishing is something, I mean, you'll never truly master. There'll always be, maybe that's not true for everyone. Maybe I know there's some people out there that at least when I look at their finishes, flawless, utterly flawless. But for the most part, if you spend enough time in this community and talking to people, you will find that finishing seems to be the thing that almost everyone unanimously dreads. And even if you've been at it for a while. Jerry writes, thanks, here's a picture of the new guitar. Yep, there it is. Let's get it up on there on the screen. And yeah, so Jerry, me, and another student, Steven, spent 9 days here, and we built two orchestra model guitars. And so you can see Jerry's right here. And then, as all students do, you guys do the finishing. There isn't enough time to do the finishing in class, so I give you guys instructions to do a true oil finish at home. And so you can see his whole setup there that he has. It looks like he's in his basement, perhaps, for doing his true oil finish. Okay, very awesome, and welcome to the Discord, Jerry. And a little bit of progress picks here. Patrick writes, got the box closed and the back binding installed. Next will be the binding and purfling on the top, and look at that Zeracote. God, I love Zeracote. I really do. Just always love looking at it. Such a cool wood. Then he also writes, box closed in and binding is done. And there's another great picture of the progress there. That redwood works so well with the Zeracote. Very cool. Another one from Patrick. Frets in, fretboard glued, threaded inserts in, neck block drilled. Almost time to start shaping the neck. And then LC Guitars. I did a bit of bracing today, and he's got some pictures of the process there. Okay, there's the X brace and the rest of the braces. And then the back looks like a three-piece back, or just, you know, a two-piece back with a prominent back stripe. And I'm not sure what wood you use there. I'd be interested to know. So that's looking great. Patrick writes, this one's coming along nicely. And he went with a maple backplate, backplate on the headstock and a maple bridge. LC Guitars, I got the body of the Dreadnought glued up today, tomorrow for the OM. Man, you guys are getting a lot done. You guys are working way faster than I am right now. It's making me feel bad. But these look great. These look great. Very cool. All right, so that's all we got for the shared progress. Let's see if we have enough time. Let's jump over to YouTube real quick. And we'll go through a couple comments in here. Okay, Kerwee writes, I've always believed one of the reasons for acoustics having quarter sawn necks is historical and dates from when nobody did scarf joints and stacked heels. On a one-piece neck, you undoubtedly need quarter sawn. With a good truss rod and three-piece construction, I've always thought that you have much more flexibility. That's a really good point, actually. I didn't think of it that way. And I think you are right, actually. A one-piece neck, for sure. So with a one-piece neck, the headstock is always a liability, even if it's quarter sawn, but it's definitely more of a liability if it's flat sawn, because you are dependent on any one of those single grain lines in the flat sawn orientation going along that angled headstock, in which case you have very short grain. So you have a combination of short grain and the fact that you're that all of that tension is resting on a single grain line at any point, and that can just snap. But at least in the quarter sawn direction, even though the grain is short along that angled headstock, at the very least, you have several grain lines across the width, so you get more support. That's a very good point that I hadn't thought of there. So thank you for adding that. And I think you might be onto something, that historical comment there. It might have to do with just how people used to make guitars. And Blaze Piano Guitars writes, hey, nice chickens. I showed you guys my chicken coop a little bit in the recent videos. I raised chickens here, and that's a little side hobby of mine. And so I got chickens at the shop. And he writes, yes, I had problems with seasonal humidity swings with the flat sawn expanding a few thousands unevenly and kind of ruined it. It was okay in summer, but not in winter. Instability, and it's now junk on the wall. Ooh, yeah, that's unfortunate. So, yeah, he's commenting on that same video about flat sawn lumber. And a couple other people, actually the next person addresses this in a way. Unwittingly, I wasn't responding to this guy, but he kind of addresses that comment because he says, with well-aged lumber, it doesn't make any difference unless you're going for figure. A large item, tables, panels, etc., you want quartered material if possible. So, yeah, with well-aged lumber, and that was one thing I was mentioning in the video, is that from what I understand, again, because I haven't worked with flat saw material for guitar necks in particular, but just knowing that this rings true for a lot of other ways that you would use flats on lumber is it really becomes more of a liability if you're at all questioning how dry the material is. If it's been aged well, it shouldn't be an issue. And so that might be what happened with Blaze Piano Guitars. But I'm sure that's enough of when that something like that happens, that's enough to sour you on the whole experience of using flat sawn lumber, and you might forever be a quarter sawn guy then at that point. Okay, Short writes, Keith Short, it should be very pretty. Mahogany is a more stable wood, but maple is harder and less prone to breaking. Your guitar will live in a climate controlled environments mostly, so it will be fine. The finished patina on the neck will be lovely. Your Shinto rasp will get a workout carving the neck. Yeah, definitely carving hard maple. My first ukulele build used some hard maple for the neck, and though not figured, it is a beauty. Yeah. which if you guys haven't seen the video that I did that they're referencing here, that is the reason primarily, or I guess totally, for using flat-sawn maple for guitar necks is for the beauty of it to get that figure to show, because in the quarter-sawn direction, you won't get it. And Robin Lee Braun writes, if you have a truss rod, it probably won't matter. For a classical guitar with no truss rod, I think you should turn it and laminate the neck. In 5 years, the owner will thank you. Yes, I would agree with that. Jonah Guitar Guy, Eric, the maple is plenty strong enough in the flat sawn orientation. And like you said, there, the figure or curl shows better in the flat sawn way. I still will cut billets to vertical grain orientation and glue them up that way just for GP. GP. I don't know what he means by GP. I hate when people use acronyms and I don't know what they mean. I'm sure if I thought about that long enough, you guys are probably shouting at the screen right now if you know what he means by GP. You will find carving hard maple is much more challenging than carving mahogany. Just finishing up a 12-fret mahogany neck carve right after a maple telly neck, huge difference. I will add to look out for what I call slash grain. The grain, whether flat or vertical, slash quarter sawn, needs to run straight through the board. I had a Fender neck that was like rubber, and the grain had extreme run out top to bottom. Okay. Excellent. GP. I don't know. You guys tell me. Or Jonah Guitar Guy, what did you mean by GP? Now I won't be able to sleep tonight. Cheapskate writes, good video. I have experimented a bit with orientation and timber species. In my opinion, quarter sawn and or laminations are really only necessary for strength if we use softwoods, which most people won't anyway. The issue with softwoods isn't strength, it's movement. So far, they seem to move with weather changes. I.e. tuning changes. Okay, so what he's saying is, yeah, the issue, and he's right, softwoods, actually, I mentioned this earlier under a different context, softwoods are affected more by temperature and humidity swings. And so you have to be more careful with things like sourcing your material and grain orientation and all that stuff. You can't be as cavalier about it as you can for the sake of aesthetics, like with guitar necks and things like that. Or like with hardwoods, I mean, not with guitar necks. Okay. I think we're going to wrap this up here. Okay, well, that was fun. Thank you, guys. Let's do it again sometime. Keep the comments coming. I'll see you guys in the next one. Bye for now. Oh, lastly, I just want to add that I will be at the Best Guitar Show. It's called The Best Guitar Show. We'll see if it actually is the Best Guitar Show. I've never been there before, but it's called The Best Guitar Show in Altoona, Pennsylvania on February 25th. So if you're in the area, or even if you're not in the area and you don't mind traveling, come check it out. There'll be tons of vendors there with guitars to check out. It's more of a vintage swap meet kind of guitar show. It's not like the Woodstock show that I talked about in other videos. That's more of a boutique acoustic guitar show. So if that's your thing, looking for really great deals on, I don't know, vintage Martins and stuff like that, it's going to be a great show for you. But then also myself, and also actually LC Guitars is the person who turned me on to this show. LC Guitars in the forums, we heard several comments from him just today in this Q&A. He'll be there as well. We'll both have booths probably right next to each other, so you can come and basically network, right? Talk to some of these people who you talk to only in the forums, and actually we can talk face-to-face, which would be pretty cool. So that's the Best Guitar Show, and it's in Altoona, Pennsylvania on February 25th. I hope you come out. Okay, bye guys.
If you learned something here, please give this video a like and subscribe so you can be notified when I release a new DIY guitar making video. And if you want to really learn more, take one of my structured online courses at ericschaferguitars.com or register for a hands-on guitar building workshop here with me in Burnville, Pennsylvania.